بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the most merciful, the most compassionate.
Ta-seen-meem.
Ta-seen-meem. Ta-seen-meem.
For comparison, see Al-Baqarah 2:47-59, Al-Araf 7:100-41, Yunus 10:75-92, Hud 11:96-109, Bani Israel 17:101-11, Maryam 19:51-3, Taha 20:1-89, Al-Mu'minun 23:45-9, Al-Shu'ara 26:10-68, Al-Naml 27:7-14, Al-Ankabut 29:39-40, Al-Mu'min 40:23-50, Al-Zukruf 43:46-56, Al-Dukhan 44:17-33, Al-Dhariyat 51:38-40, and Al-Naziat 79:15-26.
تلك آيات الكتاب المبين.
These are the verses of the clear book.
نتلو عليك من نبأ موسى وفرعون بالحق لقوم يؤمنون.
We recount to you with truth some parts of the story of Moses and Pharaoh for the benefit of those who believe.
We recount to you with truth some parts of the story of Moses and Pharaoh for the benefit of those who believe.
This book will be of benefit to those who are inclined to consider the call to the truth with an open mind. For it would be futile to recite such verses to those who are unwilling to accept the truth. To those who, by their sheer obduracy, have closed their minds to considering it with earnestness.
إن فرعون علا في الأرض وجعل أهلها شيعا يستضعف طائفة منهم يذبح أبناءهم ويستحيي نساءهم إنه كان من المفسدين.
Indeed, Pharaoh transgressed in the land and divided its people into sections. One group of them he humiliated and slew their sons and spared their daughters. Truly, he was among the mischief makers.
Indeed, Pharaoh transgressed.
The words "ala fi al-ard" mean that Pharaoh became vain and headstrong and began to transgress. Not satisfied with his true position as a human being, the position of a servant of God, he became haughty, virtually planting himself on God's throne, opposing people and ruling over them with tyranny,
and divided its people into sections.
Pharaoh did not rule over his subjects with an even hand, giving equal rights to all. Instead, he divided his subjects into various groups. He gave more rights and powers to some and enslaved, crushed, and exploited others. An objection can be raised at this point, viz., that even an Islamic state differentiates between Muslims and Dhimmis and does not grant both equal rights. This, however, is an invalid objection because in the case of an Islamic state, the distinction between the two groups is not on the basis of race, color, language, or social status, but on the basis of worldview and principles. In the Islamic system of governance, there is no difference between Muslims and Dhimmis as far as legal rights are concerned. The differences that there are pertain to political rights. The basic reason for this is that in an ideological state, leadership can only come from those who believe in the ideology of the state. All those who believe in that ideology qualify for vital leadership positions, and those who do not accept that ideology are not part of the group that provides leadership. There is no similarity, therefore, between that which obtains in the Islamic State and that which prevailed in Pharaoh's system. In the latter system, no member of the enslaved groups could ever aspire to join the ruling classes. Instead, human beings were permanently divided into the rulers and the ruled, a system in which some were not granted even basic human, let alone political and legal rights. In fact, some were even denied the right to live. In that system, there were no guarantees for the enslaved. All benefits and privileges, all material favors, all ranks were set apart for the ruling class, not because of any merit, but simply on grounds of their birth.
One group of them he humiliated and slew their sons and spared their daughters.
The Bible explains this as follows. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, peace be upon him. And he said to his people, "Behold, the people of Israel are too many and too mighty for us. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And if war befalls us, they join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore, they set taskmasters over them to inflict them with heavy burdens, and they built for Pharaoh store cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread abroad, and the Egyptians were in dread of the people of Israel. So they made the people of Israel serve with rigor, and made their lives bitter with hard service, in mortar and brick, and in all kinds of work in the field. In all their work they made them serve with rigor. Then the king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiprah and the other Puah, "When you serve as midwife to the Hebrew women and see them upon the birth stool, if it is a son, you shall kill him, but if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but let the male children live. Exodus 1:8-17. This shows that after the time of the prophet Joseph, peace be upon him, a nationalist revolution took place in Egypt, and the Copts regained power and their government had recourse to all possible means to suppress the Israelites. They did not limit their tyranny to assigning humiliating tasks to the Israelites and subjecting them to a state of ignominy and disgrace, but also devised a scheme to reduce their population by killing their male children while sparing their females. In the course of time, these female children would be married to Copts, and the children born out of such marriages would thereby be Copts. According to the Talmud, this revolution took place a little over a century after Joseph's death. The Talmud narrates in detail how the new government deprived the Israelites of their fertile lands, their dwellings, and their properties, and how it removed them from all government positions. But the tyranny of the Coptic rulers did not end there. Whenever they felt that the Israelites and their co-religionist Egyptians were gaining strength, they would humiliate them, employ them in hard labor on minimum wages, and sometimes even make them work without any wages. This is the explanation of the Quranic statement about Pharaoh's policy towards the people of Egypt. One group of them he humiliated. Verse 4. As for the attitude of the Pharaonites to the Israelites, the Quran tells us the following. "They afflicted you with dreadful suffering, slaying your males and sparing your females." Al-Baqarah 2:49. But neither the Bible nor the Quran mentions that Pharaoh had been told by some astrologer that a boy would be born among the Israelites who would overthrow him, and hence why he killed the male infants born to Israelites. There is also no mention of Pharaoh's dream, which was interpreted with exactly the same import. Quranic commentators have, however, taken over this legend from Talmudic and other Israelite traditions.
وَنُرِيدُ أَن نَّمُنَّ عَلَى الَّذِينَ اسْتُضْعِفُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنَجْعَلَهُمْ أَئِمَّةً وَنَجْعَلَهُمُ الْوَارِثِينَ.
We wanted to bestow favor on those who were oppressed in the land. We wanted to make them leaders and heirs. We wanted to make them leaders and...
That is, God would endow them with the position of world leadership.
And heirs.
That is, God would bestow upon them inheritance of the land and make them rulers.
وَنُمَكِّنَ لَهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَنُرِيَ فِرْعَوْنَ وَهَامَانَ وَجُنُودَهُمَا مِنْهُمْ مَا كَانُوا يَحْذَرُونَ.
And to grant them power in the land, and make Pharaoh and Haman and their hosts see what they had feared. And to grant them power in the land, and make Pharaoh and Haman.
Western Orientalists have heaped a mountain of criticism on this verse. They emphatically state that Haman was a courtier of the Persian king Xerxes. It is known that Xerxes ruled over Persia several centuries after Moses, peace be upon him, between 486 and 465 BC. They insist on this despite the fact that the Quran makes him Pharaoh's vizier. Now, if these Orientalists were not blinded with prejudice, they would have realized that their contention implied that before the said courtier of Xerxes, no person by the name of Haman ever existed in the world. Do they have any historical evidence to support such a contention? If any Orientalist had found any authentic list detailing the ministers, nobles, and courtiers of the pharaoh who is mentioned here, why then is such a list not published? If they have such information, it would surely help establish the point they are trying to make and could be used quite potently against the Quran. But clearly, it is not something which they possess.
وَأَوْحَيْنَا إِلَىٰ أُمِّ مُوسَىٰ أَنْ أَرْضِعِيهِ فَإِذَا خِفْتِ عَلَيْهِ فَأَلْقِيهِ فِي الْيَمِّ وَلَا تَخَافِي وَلَا تَحْزَنِي إِنَّا رَادُّوهُ إِلَيْكِ وَجَاعِلُوهُ مِنَ الْمُرْسَلِينَ
We suggested to the mother of Moses, suckle your child, but when you fear for his life, cast him into the river, and be not fearful. Nor grieve, for we shall restore him to you and make him one of the messengers. We suggested.
It is not explicitly stated here that under these circumstances a son was born to an Israeli who was to be known by the name of Moses, peace be upon him. According to the Bible and the Talmud, the family concerned descended from Levi, son of the prophet Jacob, peace be upon him, and that the name of Moses, peace be upon him, father, according to both, was Amram, called Imran in the Quran. The family already had two children before Moses' birth, a daughter named Maryam, who is mentioned in the following Quranic verses, and a son called Aaron, Harun, peace be upon him. Aaron, peace be upon him, was probably born before the decree to kill all the male infants of Israel had come into effect, and so he survived. The third child was born after the promulgation of this draconian decree.
For we shall restore him to you, and make him one of the messengers.
It was not God's command that the child be cast into the river immediately after birth. Instead, until there was a real threat to the child's life, he was to be suckled by his mother. Only when she feared that Moses' birth was known to the enemy, either by his crying or through some Israeli informer, was she to put the child into a chest and cast it into the river, and thereafter to have no fear or worry. According to the Bible, Moses' mother kept the birth of her baby secret for 3 months. The Talmud adds that Pharaoh's government employed female spies who visited Israelite homes with their own small offspring. Once in the house, they would make their own babies cry so that any baby in the house would follow suit. Moses' mother was afraid that this new means of spying would lead to the disclosure of her secret. Therefore, she cast Moses, peace be upon him, into the river 3 months after his birth. Up to this point, the biblical and Talmudic narrations are similar to the Quranic account. The mention of the way the child was cast into the river is also identical in all three sources. Put him into a chest and then throw him in the river. Taha 20:39. According to the Bible and the Talmud, Moses' mother made a chest of reeds and covered it with mud and pitch to make it waterproof. She laid the child in the chest and cast it into the Nile. But the most important detail mentioned in the Quran is absent from Israelite traditions, that Moses' mother did this at the behest of God, for she had been assured that by doing so, she would not expose the baby to any danger, that God would restore her baby to her, and that he would later become a prophet.
فالتقطه آل فرعون ليكون لهم عدوا وحزنا إن فرعون وهامان وجنودهما كانوا خاطئين
Then Pharaoh's household picked him up from the river that he may be their adversary and be a cause of sorrow to them. Surely, Pharaoh and Haman and their hosts erred in their scheming. Then Pharaoh's household picked him up from the river, that he may be their adversary and be a cause of sorrow to them.
This obviously was not what they aimed at. It was their fate. They were simply picking up a baby without knowing that he was destined to be their undoing.
وقالت امرأة فرعون قرة عين لي ولك لا تقتلوه عسى أن ينفعنا أو نتخذه ولدا عسى أن ينفعنا أو نتخذه ولدا وهم لا يشعرون.
The wife of Pharaoh said, "Here is a delight of the eye to me and to you. Do not kill him. Maybe he will prove useful for us, or we may adopt him as a son." They were unaware of the end of it all.
The wife of Pharaoh said, "Here is a delight of the eye to me and to you. Do not kill him. Maybe he will prove useful for us, or we may adopt him as a son."
It becomes clear from this statement that the chest was carried by the river to the area where Pharaoh's palaces were located. Pharaoh's servants, therefore, picked up the chest and took it to Pharaoh and his wife. It is possible, however, that the king and queen were themselves strolling along the river, and that they themselves spotted the chest and ordered that it be pulled from the river. The chest was traveling along the river from the direction of the Israelite quarters, so it was easy for them to conclude that the child was an Israelite whose male infants were then being put to the sword. So it stood to reason that an Israelite had secretly brought up their baby and, hoping that it would survive, had then cast it into the river. Presumably for these reasons, some of Pharaoh's slaves, who were possibly more royal than he, asked Pharaoh to kill the baby in order that he might not prove to be the young of a serpent who, after growing up, would bite the very hand that fed it. But to Pharaoh's wife, who probably had no children of her own, the baby was extraordinarily attractive, as God himself tells Moses, peace be upon him, "And I spread my love over you in order that you might be reared in my sight." Taha 20:39. That is, God made him so charming that whoever saw him was filled with love for him. Therefore, Pharaoh's wife could not resist asking the king that he adopt him. She thought that once he had been made their son, he would never know that he was an Israelite. He would consider himself to belong to the Pharaonic nation, and that his abilities would then be devoted to strengthening the Pharaonites rather than the Israelites. According to the Bible and the Talmud, the woman who said this was Pharaoh's daughter. The Quran, however, calls her Imra'atu Fir'aun, Pharaoh's wife, in unambiguous terms. It is obvious that God's own words are far more authentic than the traditions which were recorded hundreds of years after the event. Thus, there is no justification to translate Imra'atu Fir'aun as a woman of Pharaoh's family, merely in order to bring the Quranic statement into conformity with the Israelite traditions in disregard of Arabic idiom and linguistic usage.
وَأَصْبَحَ فُؤَادُ أُمِّ مُوسَى فَارِغًا إِن كَادَتْ لَتُبْدِي بِهِ لَوْلَا أَرَّبَطْنَا عَلَى قَلْبِهَا لِتَكُونَ مِنَ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ.
On the other hand, the heart of Moses' mother was sorely distressed. Had we not strengthened her heart, that she might have full faith in our promise, she would have disclosed the secret.
وَقَالَتْ لِأُخْتِهِ قُصِّي فَبَصُرَتْ بِهِ عَنْ جُنُبٍ وَهُمْ لَا يَشْعُرُونَ.
She told the sister of Moses, "Follow him." So she kept watch over him, unperceived by the enemies.
She told the sister of Moses, "Follow him." So she kept watch over him, unperceived.
The girl kept an eye on the chest. She did so while walking along the riverbank, always keeping it in view without giving any hint that her walk along the bank had anything to do with the chest that was floating on the river. According to the Israelite traditions, Moses' sister was about 10 or 12 years of age at that time. Her high level of intelligence, however, can be gauged from the fact that she successfully traced her brother's arrival to Pharaoh's palace.
وَحَرَّمْنَا عَلَيْهِ الْمَرَاضِعَ مِنْ قَبْلُ فَقَالَتْ هَلْ أَدُلُّكُمْ عَلَىٰ أَهْلِ بَيْتِي يَكْفُلُونَهُ لَكُمْ وَهُمْ لَهُ نَاصِحُونَ
And we had already forbidden the breasts of the nurses for the child. So seeing the girl said, Shall I direct you to the people of a household that will rear him with utter sincerity?
And we had already forbidden the breasts of the nurses for the child.
The baby would not take milk from any nurse called by the queen to suckle him.
So seeing the girl said, Shall I direct you to the people of a household that will rear him with utter sincerity?
This shows that after her brother entered the palace, his sister did not go home but remained close by. Moreover, as soon as she found out that the baby was not suckling from anyone, and the queen was in search of a nurse with whom the baby would feel at ease, she went straight to the palace and told them that she knew a nurse who would bring up the child with care and compassion. It should be remembered that in ancient times, the nobles did not raise their children themselves, but gave them over to nurses who would take them to their own homes and raise them. In the accounts of the Prophet's life, mention is made from time to time of women who would come to Mecca from outside in order to have suitable children from noble families that they would nurse. This was a service which brought them very handsome compensation. The Prophet, peace be upon him, himself was raised by Halima Sadia outside the city, in the open expanses of the desert. The same custom prevailed in Egypt at the time of Moses, peace be upon him. Hence why Moses' sister did not say that she would bring a good nurse, but simply said that she could direct them to a competent nurse who would do a good job of looking after the child, bringing him up with care and compassion.
فَرَدَدْنَاهُ إِلَىٰ أُمِّهِ كَيْ تَقَرَّ عَيْنُهَا وَلَا تَحْزَنَ وَلِتَعْلَمَ أَنَّ وَعْدَ اللَّهِ حَقٌّ وَلِتَعْلَمَ أَنَّ وَعْدَ اللَّهِ حَقٌّ وَلَكِنَّ أَكْثَرَهُمْ لَا يَعْلَمُونَ
Thus did we restore Moses, peace be upon him, to his mother, that her eyes might be comforted, and she might not grieve, and realize that the promise of Allah was true. But most people are unaware of this.
Thus did we restore Moses, peace be upon him,
According to the Bible and the Talmud, the boy was given the name of Moses in Pharaoh's house. It is not a Hebrew, but rather a Coptic word and means, I drew him out of water. In ancient Egyptian, Mo means water and Oshe means the one who has been rescued.
To his mother, that her eyes might be comforted and she might not grieve and realize that the promise of Allah was true.
The result of God's wholesome scheme was that Moses did not become a pharaonic prince in the true sense of the expression. Rather, he was brought up by his own parents, in his own house, among his own kith and kin. He therefore gained the consciousness of his own identity, family, and lineage. This upbringing made him grow into an Israelite rather than as a member of the pharaonic nation. According to a tradition, whoever works to earn his livelihood and is mindful of God's pleasure in his work is like Moses' mother, who fed her own child and was paid for it. Although such a person works to feed himself and his children, he becomes eligible for God's reward. This provided he is mindful of God's pleasure, is honest in his dealings, and considers the raising of his children and providing for them as an act of God's worship.